fascist swarm leaders of the world today. Tell them that we the people don't want another Vietnam in Afghanistan.
Remember. listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're listening to Why Violence Has Declined with Harvard professor Steven Pinker, who's interviewed by Neil Conan, the host of Talk of the Nation on National Public Radio.
So historians tracing the spread of cultures of honor from the British Isles to the to America have noted that parts of the country that were settled by Scots-Irish herders and that continued to live beyond the reach of the law, the mountainous south, the wild west, not only had higher rates of violence but maintained a culture of honor right up to the present.
Because in a sense, you pose, the government lacked legitimacy. That centralization of the government, that first part of Elias's theory, that didn't happen.
That's right. The government was slow to extend its reach to many parts of the mountainous south and to the Wild West. You remember the cliche of the cowboy movies. Mm. The nearest sheriff is 120 miles away.
Yeah, only law west of the Pecos.
Yes, so you got to defend yourself with your six-shooter. So a lot of the United States was in a state of anarchy until recently. The closing of the frontier was in the 1890s, and that was more or less the official end of anarchy in the United States. And that was pretty recent. And parts of the country where you did have to defend yourself with your six-shooter wanted to maintain that prerogative even after the government arrived.
And interestingly, you say that in Canada, this did not quite replicate because the Mounties got there before the settlers did.
Yes. So I am Canadian, and so this has special interest to me. But Canada, you look at a map, and it's this massive territory. But if you look at where the people are, they're kind of strung along a little ribbon along the American border, just because it gets too cold if you go any farther north. And Canada was settled east to west along this ribbon, and in many cases, the government and the Mounties got there first. And so there was never a state of anarchy. There was never the same need to develop a culture of honor.
Yet the experiment that you cite is conducted at that great southern University of Michigan.
Yes. Well, and the social psychologist Richard Nisbet deserves credit for exploring the psychology behind cultures of honor, particularly in the contemporary American South.
How this persisted past the closure of the frontier.
Perhaps way past the time when most Southerners were goat herds or shepherds or had livestock. But there was a certain self-perpetuating quality to many cultural traits. And he just compared northern and southern students at the University of Michigan, that is just depending on where they grew up. And he did a number of ingenious provocations. One of them, probably the most famous, was that he had people show up for a bogus experiment. And to get to the lab, they had to squeeze by a research assistant, a stooge hired by the experimenter, who left just a tiny little bit of space so you couldn't avoid brushing by him. As he was filing papers. And as he went by, he muttered an obscenity, one that we cannot say on the air. But he compared him to a certain part of our anatomy in the nether regions. And then the subject, having been insulted, his manhood impugned, shows up at the lab, and conveniently, they're taking blood samples for the experiment. They're filming it. And on the way out, they fill out all the biographical information, where you come from, and so on. What they found was that the northern students who'd been insulted kind of laughed it off, like, what's his problem? Mm-hmm. The southern students walked in fuming. They had higher levels of testosterone in their bloodstream, higher levels of cortisone, stress hormone. They greeted the experimenter with a firmer handshake. And on the way out, they strode more purposefully and forced another research assistant to step aside as they left the lab, compared to the Southerners who had not been insulted, who were perfectly genteel and fine, and the Northerners, whether or not they were insulted.
Three groups, actually. It was the Northerners, the Southerners, the Stooge was from Jersey. I say that because I'm from Jersey.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Laura, Dad, Mommy, I'm all glad that you're here. I've been meaning to talk to you, sort of a family conversation about all these calls and articles for me to not bomb Afghanistan during Ramadan.
Well, Sana, of course, it's your decision. I'd just like to say that if you stop bombing, I think it'd be bad. Bad! Let me tell you a little story about the Tet Offensive.
Dad, I'd appreciate you not using such language in front of the ladies.
That was Tet Offensive, son. Well, anyway. Yeah, if you don't laugh at this stuff, if you don't laugh, the terrorists have already won. You see, son, the Tet, well, that's the Vietnamese New Year.
I knew that. Well, but basically, I think I understand what you're saying. I'm gonna get that guy who did us wrong. The war on terror won't take holidays.
Yeah. Who dropped the bomb during Ramadan? Who stopped the fun of their fundamental sing-song? Who dropped the food on Jalalalabad? Who dropped the bags full of spam and ham and ding-dongs? The Taliban is gonna hit the fan.
And this won't be another Vietnam.
Yeah.
When my Laura said,
"Hey, W, this news is gonna trouble you."
It was time for taking off the gloves. And when my mom was saying,
"Finish it, kid, don't do like your daddy did."
Now it's time for Bush to come to shove. So I'll drop a bomb during Ramadan.
He'll stop the fun of their fundamental sing-song.
I'll drop the food on Jalalalabad.
We'll drop the bags full of spam and ham and ding-dongs.
Osama will fail, but he won't go to jail. We'll sentence him to handle U.S. mail.
Boom, Ramadan, go boom!
This progress, though, this process of civilization, as Elias put it, this is not by any means, and we've made reference to places like Pakistan, a singular arc that continues untrammeled, and that happens everywhere at the same time.
No, there's an enormous amount of unevenness in this progression. And parts of the world, it's interesting you mentioned Pakistan, particularly the Afghan-Pakistan border, which is mountainous, mm-hmm. beyond the reach of the law, and these are many of these people are herders, or recently were herders.
So and it has an elaborate code called Pashtunwali.
Yes, a culture of honor, and including the obligation to remember and avenge, to avenge insults, that whole culture. So yes, it's happened unevenly, and many of the developments that I write about in the book happen unevenly, but seem to eventually encompass the world. I mean, a good example is legal slavery, which slavery used to be just part of civilization everywhere.
It's in the Bible.
It's in the Bible. No, Bible had no problem with it. So-called democratic Athens depended on slaves. You know, it didn't seem to occur to anyone there might be something a wee bit wrong with slavery. It was really only in the 18th century that the first abolition movements arose, began in Europe, then of course many of the Northern American states. We had to have a civil war to get rid of it in the rest. But I have a curve in the book of countries and regions that abolished slavery, and that wave, which began in the 1700s, eventually swept the entire world. And so we're living in an age that, for the first time in history, slavery is not legal anywhere on Earth. Now, there's certainly human trafficking and underground slavery, but the slave auctions, the government returning slaves to their masters, economies that depended on slavery, have gone. Now, just to reinforce how uneven this was, it wasn't until 1962 that Yemen and Saudi Arabia got around to abolishing slavery. And the last holdout was Mauritania, 1980. So, I mean, that is kind of slow. On the other hand, it is now at 100%. And many of the declines are like that. They are uneven, but given enough time, they do seem to spread over the whole world.
Which gets us to really the essence of your argument, that there has been this progression, and if you look at rates of homicide, if you look at rates of death in war, not raw numbers, because on that score, the 20th century had industrialized warfare and produced absolutely horrific numbers.
The first half of the 20th century.
Bloodiest century, in even so, the bloodiest century in recorded history. But if you look at rates of deaths in battle, rates of homicide, there has been a steady progression.
Yeah. Well, if you look at rates as a proportion of the world's population, if there are more people, there are going to be more hotheads, more bloodthirsty despots, more troublemakers, and so everyone has some risk of being a victim of violence. So it is rates that are relevant. If you look at rates, it's not clear that the 20th was the worst. It was pretty bad, but you know, other centuries had their bloodbaths too. The 14th century was a pretty nasty place with Mongol invasions, and every time a dynasty fell in China, you could have tens of millions of deaths. We just aren't taught that in our history classes. But then after World War II, a funny thing happened, which is that not just the rate, but the absolute number of people dying in war went down bumpily. I mean, it wasn't a straight line. There were some spikes for Korea and Vietnam and Iran, Iraq. But people haven't noticed this, but for the last couple of decades, the worldwide rate of death in war and numbers, forget even rates, just how many people die in war, is kind of hugging the floor by world standards. We don't notice it because if there's some part of the world that isn't having a war, you don't have a reporter with a camera saying, here I am in Nicaragua, and another year, and there's no war.
That's right. You don't make much of a listen saying, no news here.
Yeah. So you don't appreciate until you see the numbers. But the post-World War II era has been sometimes called the long peace. Again, it's hard to believe if you remember the particular wars. You got to remember what didn't happen, but which could have happened, and which did happen for centuries before, such as big, powerful, rich countries fighting each other. That was just a constant of history. That's what great powers did. You know, England and Germany and France and Germany and Italy and Austria, and name a pair, and you can find a war between them in the history books. As of 1945, European countries, rich countries, powerful countries, stopped fighting each other. A very good thing, because it's the rich countries that can do the most damage when they get into a war. The U.S. and the Soviet Union, every expert predicted that World War III was a certainty, just a matter of time, and that it would be a nuclear war. To everyone's surprise, it didn't happen. And then there were a lot of nasty proxy wars, colonial wars, wars in the Southern Hemisphere. But after the end of the Cold War, those started to peter out as well. And the long peace started to spread to the rest of the world.
And immediately people will look up and say, Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, and the massacres at Srebrenica, what's going on today in Syria. The people will say, how can you possibly make this argument that we may be living in the most peaceful era in human existence?
Yes, it's because the rates of violence haven't gone down to zero. And wherever the violence occurs, that's where the news people go. There's always, if it bleeds, it leads. There's always enough violence to fill the news. And so if your impression of how violent the world is comes from the news, you'll think, well, there's just no shortage of violence. It's the same as it ever was. It's only when you remember, first of all the places in the world that are not at war, and you do the comparison of two points in time, which is kind of what a trend is. Mm-hmm. You can't really talk about a trend by looking at what's happening now. Just mathematically, that doesn't make any sense. And it's when you look at the trends and when you look at the data that you see how far we've come. Now, you've mentioned a few wars, but when a curve goes down like that, kind of a declining sawtooth, we remember the spikes, but we forget the lowlands in between the spikes. We also don't mentally compute how many people are killed in each war. Even the horrific wars that we have today, like in Syria, where there's no minimizing the human tragedy there. And you don't want to say, well, you know, it's only 20,000 people. I mean, that's 20,000, you know, men, women, and children. On the other hand, you look at the Iran-Iraq war, that was in the hundreds of thousands. You look at the Vietnam War, that was maybe 2 to 3 million, to say nothing of the world wars. So the wars that do take place are far less destructive of human life than they used to be. Again, something that if you just see something blowing up, you can't appreciate. It's only the nerds who count the bodies that can tell us that that wars have are getting less destructive.
And this is not just sort of a rose-colored view of the present, which obviously you acknowledge there's terrible things going on, but it's also important to look at the past with the proper perspective, that it wasn't also great back before the second half of the 20th century, and indeed, back in prehistory, when a lot of people would argue, hunter-gatherer societies were essentially peaceful, warfare was symbolic, not much really happened, and that mankind grew up and developed war as a cultural affectation rather than something that's in our nature.
Yes, there is the what's sometimes called the myth of the noble savage, the romantic idea that people living in as foragers, as hunter-gatherers, as hunter-horticulturalists lived in a state of harmony until the Westerners came. Now, the Westerners undoubtedly did a lot of damage and committed.
The Romans have a lot to answer for. Yeah.
Romans have. On the other hand, the rates of death in tribal raiding and feuding were sky high as a percentage of the population. So, in many non-Western pre-state societies, you could have death rates of 25%, 30%, 40%, way higher than even in our world wars. So violence has always been a problem. These societies had mechanisms to try to minimize war. They didn't work all that well. They worked sometimes, and with the result that back then the rates were very high.
And there have been people who have observed tribes in places like New Guinea in their warfare and noticed that they would stand about the maximum distance of their projectiles, their bows and arrows for the most part, or spears, launch them at each other. They were largely ineffectual, and that they would then retreat to their various camps, and, well, honor was satisfied. Yet you make an unsettling comparison to our closest primate cousins, the chimpanzees.
Yes, well,
in your interest, did you shrug your shoulders? Do as you were told, hang a flag in your window. Buy the goods that you were sold, or did you shut off his craven image? Call the man a liar, did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? You know, the ones with darker skin, clerks and teachers, engineers with names like Sammy and Mazin. When they were breaking down the doors, taking them away, holding them on secret charges, hidden from the light of day, what did you tell their children? When you had a chance to meet, could you look them in the eye? Or did you walk past them on the street? Could you say that you stood up when their lives were on the wire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? children lost their lives, lying broken on the pavement as the ambulance arrives. When the soldiers opened fire with their heavy guns, could you see the demonstrators hit the ground? See how their red blood runs? What were you doing? On this fateful times, did you raise your voice against these awful crimes? Or were you hiding in your bedroom when the situation was so dire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? When the time had come and the Reich was at your door, when the fascist state was here and they brought home the war, when the Gestapo was in the city and they'd really taken power, when there was nothing left to do, here in the final hour, did you find a place to run to where you might live a few more years while the slaughter was around you? Did you cover up your ears, or did you set your sights, take your aim and fire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire?
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.